Capitol Hill Talks. I'm Andy Walters.
During the period of 1991 to 2003, the UN Security Council imposed heavy economic sanctions on Saddam Hussein's Iraq. During that time, because the sanctions prevented Iraqis from obtaining basic medical supplies and materials to rebuild their infrastructure, by some estimates, up to 500,000 children died as a direct result of the sanctions. In 1997, my guest, Bert Sachs, traveled to Iraq to deliver $40,000 worth of medicine. For this, he was fined $10,000 by the U.S. government in 2002 under the Trading with the Enemy Act. After 10 long years in court and two legal cases, a Seattle judge on December 28th finally dismissed the case with prejudice. Bert, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the issues, I'd like to talk about your story to get some context. You made the trip to Iraq 9 different times.
That's right.
Take me to the moment that you first arrived at a Basra hospital and saw the suffering of children. What went through your head?
Well, the first hospital I went to was in 1996, and it was the Qadisiyah Hospital in Baghdad. And we had no minder. We went to a cheap hotel. We just got a taxi in the morning, and we went to this hospital. And I can remember very clearly going into the pediatric ward. We just showed up, explained we're here to gather evidence, to see what conditions are like. And we went to a children's ward. And it was October or November, and it gets to be cold in Baghdad, in Iraq, in the winter. And the only heat in this room was a small electric heater on the floor. And there were two young children who were in their hospital beds with their mothers. And one had her head in a bandage, and I never actually understood from the doctor what the problem or how serious that was. But the other child was an infant. And the mother was sitting with the infant, and the doctor explained this child had part of the intestines born outside of the body. And normally that's correctable in certainly in Western hospitals. And the prognosis was not good because the sanctions that the US had imposed, which included medicines, the UN sanctions never included medicines, meant that this hospital didn't have antibiotics, didn't have basic essentials that you expect every hospital to have, including even clean water, including electricity. And that image has stayed with me, and that's one of the images I have of the suffering that we have brought to the Iraqi people.
So how did you get the idea to deliver the medicine to the Iraqis?
In 1996, I learned that a man was coming out here who'd been to Iraq with a group called Voices in the Wilderness.
Coming out here, you mean Seattle?
To Seattle, that's right. His name is Jim Douglas. And so I read a book that he'd written, and I was very impressed by the book, and I went to hear him talk. And I was very impressed by the man. And I spoke to him afterwards, and I said, well, if this is the kind of person that's going to Iraq to bring medicines, bring back the evidence of what's happening there, sign me up. There was not a long waiting list. And so I called the organization he'd gone with called Voices in the Wilderness, which is run out of a small apartment in Chicago by Kathy Kelly. And so in that was the summer of that year. In October of that year, I went on the fourth delegation of Voices in the Wilderness, my first. And that's a trip we went to Baghdad, the hospital I'm telling you about, and we went to Basra, a big city in the south, the second largest city in Iraq.
After you delivered the medicine, how long was it until the government got involved and imposed the fine?
That's also an interesting story. I came back, and so I was there in 96, and then January of the next year was coming on the anniversary of the start of the Gulf War. And I remember being in my apartment and thinking, what do I need to do next? What should I be doing? I've seen the suffering. I'd researched it enough not to have much question in my mind that this is a terrible thing my country is doing. And I decided if I could get this into a court of law, then I could present the evidence. And in a court of law, there are rules of evidence. You just can't open your mouth and assert anything. And you can be cross-examined, you can be questioned. Well, I decided what I should do is to try and get myself prosecuted. So I went to the office of the federal attorney for this Western Washington region. And she's a very nice woman, Kate Flaumer at the time, under Clinton in 96, 97. And she said, "What can I do for you?" And I say, "I'd like you to fine me for going to Iraq to bring medicine." And she said, "I won't do that for you." She knew what I was after. But I didn't give up. So then I thought, well, I go to the FBI. And I went to the FBI's office in the federal building. And young, nice guy. But he said, "You're in the wrong place. We don't handle that. You want to go across the street to the Office of Foreign Assets Control. It's the branch of the Treasury that handles sanctions." So I thanked him, and he, as he sent me off, say, "Good luck getting busted," was what he wished me. I thanked him. Went over to the Office of Foreign Assets Control. They, two guys sat me down at a table. They saw me. And one of them said to me, "Oh, we don't want to mess with you. We're not concerned about this." The other guy, I'm quite sure, took the letter that I had written to about this to my supporters and to educate about it, and he took it, and I'm quite sure he sent it back to Washington, D.C. Reason I'm sure about that is because the next time I led, the next delegation I was on, when we came back through the United States, entered into the country and had our passports checked, there was a flag on the computer for immigration, and we were taken aside. We'd correctly said where we'd been. We'd been to Iraq. And we were genteel interrogation. I don't want to make it sound...
You weren't waterboarded.
No, thank goodness. We weren't tortured. But the people didn't have a form for Iraq. They had a form for Cuba. So they took the form for Cuba, crossed out Cuba, wrote Iraq in it, and had each one of us sign the form. What we'd violated the sanctions regime by bringing medicines and going to Iraq without getting a license from the government. So that's what led to the fine against me about a year later.
Okay.
And eventually in 2002, I got fined. And that was when I went back to Washington, D.C. and had a news conference.
And did you regret it once the fine actually came into play? I mean, was it kind of like a reality check?
I can remember lying in bed before I went and did this when I think saying to myself, "I hope I know what I'm doing."
Yeah.
And the guy who interviewed me for the PI had a good ending quote from me, which was, "Well, there's part of me that's afraid." It wasn't a criminal case, which they could have brought. It was a civil case. But it was a hefty fine, nonetheless. But I said to this guy, "Finally, I'm glad I'm walking my talk." And that feels good. And it feels good to all of us when we do that, when we really say, okay, this is what I believe, and I need to act on what I believe.
So you actually could have been criminally prosecuted.
That's right.
Wow.
12 years in jail is that, what the maximum fine would be.
Wow. This issue of Iraq is not, I mean, you didn't come from academia to this issue. You were an engineer by trade. How did you get interested in this to begin with?
In 1994, I had a high school reunion back in Boston, near Boston, where I grew up. And I decided I'm going to go to that. And also it would let me do something I've wanted to do, which is to check on a story that the Washington Post published in 1991, in June of that year. And the story said, a team of us from called the Harvard Study Team have gone to Iraq. Their doctors, their engineers, their lawyers, and all these people, to see what the Gulf War had done. And what they said was the bombing had destroyed 96% of the electrical generating capacity of Iraq. They said, that means you can't pump water and you can't process sewage. And they estimated that 170,000 children were going to die. Well, I hadn't heard anything about it anymore. So I said, well, I'm back in Boston. I'll go to Harvard School of Public Health. So I did that, and I finally got the name of a woman who had been on that team. I called her up when I got back here. She's living in New York. And she said, you want to know what's happening in Iraq? Go to a medical library and read the New England Journal of Medicine from September of 1992. And I actually have that right here. The title of the article is Special Article, Effect of the Gulf War on Infant and Child Mortality in Iraq. The abstract conclusions say, these results provide strong evidence that the Gulf War and trade sanctions caused a threefold increase in mortality among Iraqi children under 5 years of age. We estimate that in excess of more than 46,900 children died between January and August 1991. Almost 50,000 children in 8 months, and we hadn't heard of it? Well, that's an important fact just in itself, that our media didn't cover that story. And because of that, reading that, I said to myself, I can't leave this alone. I don't want to be like I had been earlier in my life. I don't want to be like so many Americans are, where you hear something and you say, I don't want to know that. And this has become my issue, and that's how I got involved.
Well, that's good background, and that brings us to some of the issues that I wanted to talk about. One of them is, so in an interview with Talking Stick TV, you called the U.S., or what the U.S. did to Iraq, an international act of terrorism. In what sense?
Well, let me quote to you one more thing. This is from the woman who is the former U.S. federal attorney. Two short sentences. Article 54 of the Geneva Convention states, quote, it is prohibited to attack, destroy, or render useless objects indispensable to the survival of a civilian population, end quote, and includes foodstuffs, livestock, and, quote, drinking water supplies and irrigation works. The quotes are internal. Everything I'm saying now is from her op-ed piece in the Seattle PI. Okay, again. Title 18, U.S. Code Section 2331 defines international terrorism as acts dangerous to human life that would violate a criminal law if done in the United States, when those acts are intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Well, there are two requirements if you want to call this terrorism, what we did. One is it dangerous to human life? Well, 46,900 children in 8 months, that is clearly dangerous to human life. And the other point you have to make that claim is that it was done to intimidate or coerce a government. Well, on that point, I will read to you this quite amazing quote that nobody else seems to know also, which is a quote from James Baker III, who was our Secretary of State at the time. And he said in May of 91, this is a couple months after the end of the Gulf War, quote, that means we will never normalize relations with Iraq so long as Saddam Hussein remains in power. That means maintaining UN sanctions in place so long as Saddam remains in power. Okay? Coerce a government? What we're saying is, look at guys, we're going to keep killing your children, 195, 165 a day, until you overthrow Saddam Hussein. Isn't that terrorism? If we did it with bombs, it would be very clear. If we do it with unsafe drinking water, does that make a difference? No.
And talk a little bit about, I think to buttress that case, talk a little bit about what the U.S. did to Iraq's infrastructure.
Right. That's crucial to understand the impact of the sanctions, because in 1991, the strategy was to take out all the electrical plants, almost all of them. And there are quotes in that original Washington Post front page story that I mentioned before that got me involved in this in the first place, is a quote from one of the Pentagon bombing planners. It sums it up in one short paragraph. Let me read that to you. This is from the Washington Post. This is a planning officer, a Pentagon planning officer. Quote, people say, you didn't recognize that it was going to have an effect on water or sewage, said the planning officer. Well, what were we trying to do with the United Nations economic sanctions? Help out the Iraqi people? No. What we were doing with the attacks on infrastructure was to accelerate the effect of sanctions. Okay? We took out the electrical plants. We knew that they couldn't pump water, they couldn't process sewage, and that was part of our goal to have, quote, long-term leverage, as another planner put it, and to overthrow Saddam. And why did we want to overthrow Saddam? Well, I don't have any direct quote, but we'd supported him for 12 years before. We wanted to overthrow him because we wanted to put our guy in power who would do the same kind of things the House of Saud would do for us, give us control of the oil. We tell them to pump oil, they'll pump oil. We tell them turn it off or make deals with this oil company from the United States or what the West, and they would do it. And that's what we wanted. And we didn't want to have to send American troops in. But after 12 years and 500,000 deaths of Iraqi children is a low estimate. We didn't get what we wanted, so we used the excuse of September 11th that had nothing to do with Iraq as a justification for going to war and sending soldiers to get military access to this oil-rich region.
So the counterargument there is made that there's an estimate that said the after the Gulf War, Iraq was at about, its army was at about 30% of its capacity. And the sanctions helped keep it there. So the sanctions didn't let the Iraqi army rebuild. And of course, the Iraqi army had invaded Kuwait. You know, no one's arguing that they were a force for good. So couldn't you argue that the sanctions were a way to curb their influence for the betterment of the Middle East?
Just looking out now, can anyone seriously who knows what's happened in Iraq think that what has happened is a consequence of our policy of 500,000 deaths, if you think of that, and then our invasion, our illegal invasion of Iraq, and our occupation until we finally more or less left, has made things better in the Middle East? I think anyone who knows the reality of what's been happening in Iraq. And now we're talking about not just the military, we're talking about a civilian population of something like 25 million people, of which there are several million who are internal refugees who fled the country because of all the violence that our invasion created. So what we have done to that country, from the point of view of the suffering that has been brought there. Now we're talking 500,000 children. If that happened in this country, scaled up to our population, we'd be talking 6 million children. Can anyone think that whatever might happen, whatever possible positive benefits there could be justified by the deaths of 6 million American children or 500,000 Iraqi children? That comes from UNICEF, by the way, that number. There's so much negative consequences, least of all to mention the credibility of the United States as a force for good in the world.
Well, on that point, so it is true that Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in 1995 proposed the Oil for Food program. And it was actually proposed in 1991, before that, right. But Saddam Hussein refused it. So I think one could argue that at least the UN never intended for there, and in fact, there was never a UN embargo on medicine or food. So I think you could make the case that it was actually Saddam who, by refusing the Oil for Food program, made it worse on his population, and that it wasn't actually the United States or the UN's fault.
Okay. Going back to the issue of the sanctions and the Oil for Food program, there are many of us who would support sanctions on military equipment. And in fact, of course, people should know the biggest arms dealer in the world is the United States of America. We import and export more arms than any other country. We also are responsible for selling Saddam Hussein some of the weapons. The joke is we know that he had weapons of mass destruction because we have the receipts for them. The precursor for, it's a sad joke actually, it's very sad. When he used poison gas against the Iranians, we didn't protest. We continued to loan him money.
As did other Western powers. I think France did the same thing.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we, the United States, kept the Iraqi report back to the Security Council about where they were hidden, and we sanitized it. So we took out all of the references so that it wouldn't become public the extent to which the United States and France and other European countries sold Saddam Hussein the weapons that he had. It is not that those of us who have gone over and seen the suffering in Iraq are opposed to sanctions per se of any kind. And we support sanctions against weapons. But that's different from sanctions against water purifiers.
Well, actually, on that particular point, so that's an interesting case because we sanctioned chlorine.
Yes.
Because chlorine could be used in chemical weapons, but it was also a really important chemical for water purification.
When it became so clear that the major killer of children was waterborne diseases, finally the political pressure, public relations pressure, got so great that the Security Council, essentially, you can understand the United States, with Great Britain dragged behind, agreed to do what would have been possible quite early, which is to have chlorine canisters monitored by the United Nations and allowed for purification. But water pumps, just repairing the electrical plants, you don't make weapons of mass destruction out of having electrical generators. We could have allowed that. We could have allowed them to sell the oil for those purposes. We didn't do those things for the reason Madeleine Albright herself states. And if I can quote that.
Yeah.
Madeleine Albright, in her book, when she said years to think about her unfortunate statement where Leslie Stahl said, we've heard nearly 500,000 children have died from the sanctions. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? And Madeleine Albright answered, I think it's a very hard choice, but the price we think is worth it. That's from her book. And she says, I must have been crazy to cite this. But then she says the sentence, Saddam Hussein could have prevented any child from suffering simply by meeting his obligations. Well, I ask you all to stop and think what that says. It says, we are using sanctions, which we know are not causing suffering, but are causing death. These are deadly sanctions. We're using this in order to force a brutal, ruthless dictator, we say, to meet his obligations. That's terrorism. In 1991, Thomas Friedman, in the New York Times, July 7th, said this, quote, sooner or later, Mr. Bush argued, sanctions would force Mr. Hussein's generals to bring him down, and then Washington would have the best of all worlds, an iron-fisted Iraqi junta without Saddam Hussein. Friedman, an iron-fisted junta without Saddam Hussein, not concerned about bringing democracy to Iraq. 10 years later, in February of 2001, again in the New York Times, he says this, quote, Saddam totally outfoxed Washington in the propaganda war. All you hear and read in the media here is that the sanctions are starving the Iraqi people, which is true. That's Friedman, which is true. But the United States counterarguments that by complying with UN resolutions, Saddam could get those sanctions lifted at any time are never heard. Well, wait a second. 10 years before, he said, we're going to keep the sanctions, Friedman said, until we replace Saddam with another iron-fisted general, junta, who will do what we tell him to do. And then 10 years later, he makes this ridiculous argument that if Saddam complies with the UN resolution regulations, we'll lift the sanctions,
which
we never did. And Saddam Hussein, whatever you want to say about him, had complied. And there were no weapons of mass destruction. And we invaded on the basis of a lie, which I believe we had to know was a lie. We simply had to ask the UNSCOM people, the weapons inspectors, how many weapons have you found since 1994 or 95? None.
So on that point, I think the policy of sanctions, from what I understand, you're right in that it was not initially intended, or that it was initially intended to be a regime change policy.
Yes.
Didn't work. And then I think it evolved into a containment policy.
I think even containment, the idea that if we simply said to Saddam Hussein, if you cross your borders, you'll be at war with the United States again. You don't want that.
Right.
And he was not irrational, and he didn't cross the borders, and he knew that. So it wasn't containment. I think it was political consequence of having so demonized one man that any time you said, what about these children starving? What about the unsafe water? People in the political spectrum would say, you're being soft on Saddam, as if it was Saddam who was suffering. And that's the kind of crazy political environment we live in this country.
But to be fair, Saddam really used the sanctions to sort of play them up. In the New York Times, there was a quote from a doctor in Bakuba, Iraq, and as he was saying, manipulation happened all the time. For example, we would get a shipment from the Ministry of Health, I'm quoting now, we would get a shipment from the Ministry of Health vaccines provided by the WHO, but then we would be instructed not to use them until they had reached or even exceeded their sell-by date. Then the television cameras would come, and we would be told to lie and tell the public how the UN made ordinary Iraqis suffer. And he says, you have to understand, this was a system where everyone knew what was expected at the time, what was expected of them. Most of the time, we didn't even have to be told what to do. So I think it's fair to say, right, that Saddam exaggerated the impacts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he probably, I don't know if he won the propaganda war, but he certainly did better than we expected.
Okay. Let's talk about propaganda. Of course, Saddam wanted to have the sanctions lifted. And of course, he was less skillful than people in this country are in dealing with propaganda and message control. And of course, Western media saw it that way and saw his attempts to try and call attention to what the sanctions were doing. The sanctions were doing these things. There's no question about that. And if he was crude in trying to highlight that, I think he was. But let's look at American propaganda. The New England Journal of Medicine reported 46,900 deaths of children. That's probably our most credible medical journal. Okay? Who covered it? Talk about propaganda. Well, the New York Times covered it in a good half-page story because an American doctor had gone to Iraq, and the New York Times covered it only in the Long Island edition, did not cover it nationally. The deaths of 50,000 children was not considered a news story that we had to know nationally. And then later, when UNICEF reported 500,000 deaths of Iraqi children in 1999, who covered that? Well, it was a story, but that central fact, the one that's intelligible to everybody, 500,000 dead children, was omitted from 48 of the top 50 newspapers in the country. And that's the major newspapers, too. The New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post did not report that statistic. Worse than that, the nightly news programs, ABC, NBC, CBS, did not even report it for 90 days after that report when people checked the transcripts. Talk about propaganda. Talk about news coverage that's simply for the benefit of the government, of the country. Well, I don't think we can be so proud of our own media.
So I want to get a little bit back to the case about sanctions in particular. There's a couple of more points I want to go through. So you talked about the UNICEF study that showed that child mortality rates, you didn't say this, but it's the same study, child mortality rates doubled under sanctions. But in that same study, in the autonomous North Kurdish region, child mortality rates actually fell. That was in Iraq. They fell from 80 to 72 births per 1,000. So the argument there is that doesn't this go to show that Saddam is to blame, again, not the Security Council, that Saddam was withholding medicine from the people, whereas in the north, where they're still under sanctions, mm-hmm. but they're not under Saddam's control, mortality rates were fine.
That's one of the common points. And so let me answer that. Richard Garfield is often cited as the expert on mortality statistics in Iraq. And he wrote a letter listing some of the obvious reasons why conditions in the north would be better than conditions in the rest of the South Central region. And the New York Times refused to publish it after they had made this point and gone on with this propaganda, essentially. Well, here are some of the things that Richard Garfield cited in his letter. He said, first off, with waterborne diseases, clearly the water is purer and better coming from the north, coming from Turkey, and flowing down the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And the further downstream you get, the more polluted it is. So people in the north are having, to start with, pure water. Secondly, the Oil for Food program gave 13% more money, I believe that's the correct number, to people in the north, because the 13% that was taken out of the rest of the country for the remunerations for
Kuwait
and for other people that complained, that said Iraq owes us money because of the Gulf invasion, because of the invasion of Kuwait, that wasn't taken out of the money that the people in the north had in what we can call Kurdistan. Finally, another point is that the people in the north got cash. Saddam Hussein was never given a penny of cash, which meant that if you had to hire somebody to do some work, to put in water pumps or fix the electricity, you had no cash to pay for it, whereas people in the north had a significant component. I think it was 10% of the monies coming to them was available as cash. So those are like three obvious factors that account for that difference. And people that make that argument, I don't think, are often paying attention to those factors.
Okay. So people will make the case, all right, so the humanitarian, Madeleine Albright makes this case, right, that the humanitarian costs were indeed high, but that there was a countervailing benefit. And that benefit was to bring Saddam to the negotiating table and basically to incentivize the monitoring and disarmament of Iraq's dangerous weapons, right? So to that point, there was an article in Foreign Affairs in July 2004 by George Lopez and David Courtwright. And here's what they said, I quote, "In discussion of the resolution 715, which that's the UN Security Council resolution, which mandated continuous monitoring to prevent Iraqi rearmament in 1992, Iraqi leaders told UN officials that they wanted concrete assurances that sanctions would be lifted before Iraq would agree to accept the OMV system. They hoped that accepting monitoring would bring them benefits from the Security Council." So the idea is that, the UNSCOM at the time chairman said this, that it was a combined carrot and stick approach. The carrot was lifting the sanctions and the stick was the sanctions, and that helped disarm Iraq. And that was the big benefit. What do you say to that?
Well, a lot of things. Iraq was disarmed by about 1984. That is, that was about the last date that UNSCOM found any weapons of mass destruction. I'm not talking about the paper chase. Essentially, from that point on, they were looking for all the paper to prove that this nut and this bolt and this component and that were all had been destroyed.
You're talking about WMDs in that case, right? Not like chemical weapons.
No, including chemical weapons and biological weapons were included under the category of WMDs under the UN Security Council.
But didn't Saddam use chemical weapons in 1991?
He used them before that against the Iranians, and we argued after the fact that he used them against his own people, and that was terrible. But at the time that he did it, he was still our buddy, and we dismissed that and said, don't worry about it, and we're not sure what it is, and maybe they were Iranians, and maybe the Iranians did it. So the underlying issue here is one of honesty, is one of truthfulness. Are we being truthful in the things we assert and in our motives? And you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool everybody all of the time. And a lot of the world is seeing that our claims don't hold up when challenged by people that don't have a bias in the issue, like the two UN Assistant Secretary Generals who's resigned their positions to protest what the sanctions were doing. They had seen the United Nations turned into a weapon of mass destruction against the Iraqi people. 500,000 children, and 1 million more beyond that. Essentially by the United States, which held the veto power in the Security Council. And in terms of the carrot and...
Carrot and stick approach.
Stick approach. We applied the stick plenty. We never applied the carrot. When we saw weapons being destroyed, and we had all the evidence from UNSCOM that they were destroyed, and UNSCOM went to the places where they were bombed and just blown up and destroyed, we never gave a carrot. We didn't let up at all in the sanctions. Only if it was public opinion pressure, with all the deaths, that let us release a little bit. And the people that were responsible for checking all of this, those two UN assistant secretaries, so much testified contradicting the claims that Madeleine Albright, for example, Madeleine Albright said, we never embargoed medicine. That's not true. There's fines against people for bringing medicines to Iraq. And Madeleine Albright said Saddam Hussein spent a huge amount of money building palaces. Well, he did build palaces, but if you use her number of $2 billion a year and do a simple calculation, it comes to 4 cents a day per person. Now, is that why the children are starving? I don't think so. So there are so many contradictions in the U.S. position, in the U.S. claims, that they need to be answered. But they need to be answered to the broad public, who simply only hears what our media has been saying and not saying, not putting in the media what needs to be said. And that's not good journalism. That's biased journalism.
Bert, you became a student of nonviolence.
I think it happened in the same way that I think it's happening in the world. We're looking at what violence does. We're looking at the consequences. I remember a Vietnam vet, an Iraqi vet also, his son, saying to me, well, the consequence of war is then peace. And I thought to myself, he was saying that just a few years ago when we're fighting two wars, and where does he see peace coming after that, and for how long? And there must be a better way. And the kind of conventional alternative is effectively appeasement. And we understand that's not a good policy either. And yet, as I've come to think about this and then go to workshops and conferences and hear people speak and read books about it, I've been coming to realize that we've been shown what the alternative is. And there are a lot of scholars and thinkers who are presenting many different aspects of nonviolence. And I use the term nonviolence as distinct from pacifism because, in effect, that was the term that Gandhi used. And I think the most dramatic and powerful example of the power of nonviolence was given to us by Gandhi. And Gandhi and his movement of nonviolent non-cooperation with the British helped overthrow the British Empire and get them to leave India, but to leave with what Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, said was, Gandhi made it impossible for us to remain, us the British, to remain in India, the crown jewel of our empire, but he made it possible for us to leave with dignity. The essence of nonviolence can be said to be having respect for all parties, for the human beings who are acting, at the same time that you are can be strong and even intransigent in opposing the things that you believe in principle are so wrong that the other party may be doing. And that applies to everybody. And so,
including even like Saddam Hussein, who is
yes.
a very, very bad person.
Especially demonizing, because it is demonizing of one person, of Saddam Hussein, for example, who certainly did torture. I'm a member of Amnesty, I've read the reports. But who also did other things. He built a socialist country where an awful lot of the oil revenues went to help improve the health conditions of the people in his country, the education conditions, and UNICEF and UNESCO winning awards for education, providing electricity and safe water for the large majority of people. So the demonization which we did of him made it sound like everyone who was born in the country was born with a mustache and was just a new Saddam Hussein waiting to grow up. And that allowed us to blind ourselves to what we were doing to the people of that country. If the UNICEF report had said Saddam Hussein was responsible for 500,000 Iraqi children, where would that story be in our media? It would be the lead story in all of our networks. Where was it when we said we did that? And people want to say, well, didn't we get something good from that? Didn't we overthrow a dictator? Well, the price for that was never mentioned. Not on the networks and hardly at all, not in the major newspapers in our country. Well, Gandhi said about nonviolence that there is a coin. One side of that coin has the word nonviolence on it, and the other side has the word truth. And so truth and nonviolence are two sides of the same coin. The implication of that is there's another coin, I think, the converse of that, which is where there's a coin that says violence, there's another side of that which says untruth. And our violence against Iraq and so much against Afghanistan and our threats and Israel's threats against Iran are based on so much untruth. And the untruth isn't necessarily untruths of commission. They can be untruths of omitting crucial things that we need to know. And I cited the demonization of Saddam as what justified and the omitting of the price that we have made them pay. If I were to speak about Iran, I would say the most central thing I can think Americans need to know, which is omitted so much and so ignored, is what the United States did in 1953. In 1953, the U.S. sent Kermit Roosevelt, I think grandson of one of the Roosevelt presidents, to overthrow the democratically elected leader, very popular leader, of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. Mohammad Mossadegh was the Time magazine man of the year, but he had the audacity to believe that oil in Iran belonged to the Iranian people and not to the company that was to become British Petroleum. Well, we overthrew the government there, and the people, young people, people that were never born in 1953, many, many people, a lot of people in Iran know about this. It's part of their real history. How many Americans know about that? And if we knew about that, how would that alter our understanding of Iranian-American relations and angers that they have towards us? We demonize whoever we see as the enemy, and we completely forget that we're supposed to be a Christian nation, And the most central teaching, I think, of Christianity comes from Jesus Christ, who said, love your enemy. Love your enemy. He didn't say tolerate. He didn't say fight just wars against. He said correctly, beginning with the inner state. Can you do that? Can you cultivate love in such a way that then you look out and you'll decide whatever you have to do, even in the very extreme case, you don't do it out of anger. You don't do it out of hatred. You don't do it because you've demonized that person, but rather you've tried to cultivate inside of yourself an understanding of why those people do what they do. That's what the heart of nonviolence is, looking out and seeing the world in a different way than the way we've been taught.
To the argument that sanctions are a nonviolent means.
Yes.
What would you say?
I think certain kind of sanctions can be. And you have to ask the important questions, what conditions would justify that? For example, in South Africa, when the African National Congress called sanctions, the majority of people in the country called sanctions on themselves and on the South African regime, and to the extent they could be targeted against the ruling parties of apartheid, that's even better. And they should never include essential needs of the people. So that's contrary to what we did with Iraq. And it seems to me, well, it's not an area that I'm very knowledgeable about. I'm suspicious that it's also what we're trying to do with Iran. And the New England Journal called this a war on public health. Sanctions on Cuba and sanctions on Iraq, the New England Journal said, is at essence a war on public health. You should not wage a war on public health. It's immoral. You lose credibility. You lose moral authority. Jimmy Carter just wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying we're losing our moral standing in the world. So some sanctions imposed thoughtfully without trying to hurt civilian populations can be useful and something that I would support and can be called, I think, much more, can be called essentially nonviolent. Sanctions that kill 165 children every day cannot.
Thanks for coming on the show, Bert.
You're welcome. Thank you for all your good questions.